Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on lies that my teacher told me right after this. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Quite a statement. I wish I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, more gun control. But you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years, and that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from our political process, certainly not from our politicians, lawyers, or bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, I could echo that by saying, you give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America comes from our courts, not our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Hey, last time I said we'd talk about Christopher Columbus. You know, we've got our views of Columbus. We have October the 12th every year that we observe. We actually call things pre-Columbian, or we use the term Hail Columbia. What we're really talking about here is Columbus. That's the name that we apply to Columbus and the period of time, 1492, and after that, that we call post-Columbian, and then 1492, and prior to that is called pre-Columbian. Well, in 1492, Christopher Columbus called in or sailed in from the blue. Now, American history books present Columbus pretty much without precedent. And they portray Columbus as America's first great hero. And in so canonizing Columbus, they reflect our national culture. And indeed, now that President's Day has been combined, that is, Washington's and Lincoln's birthdays, Columbus is one of only two people that the United States honors by name in a national holiday. The one date that every school child remembers is 1492, and sure enough, all 12 textbooks that I surveyed included it. But they leave out virtually everything that is important to know about Columbus and the European exploration of the Americas. Meanwhile, they make up all kinds of details to tell a better story and to humanize Columbus so that the readers will identify with him. Now, Columbus, like Christ, was so pivotal that historians use him to divide the past into epochs, making the Americas before 1492 pre-Columbian. And American history textbooks recognize Columbus's importance by granting him an average of 800 words. That's 2.5 pages, including a picture and a map. That's a lot of space in a history textbook, considering all of the material that these books must cover. Their heroic collective account goes something like this. Born in Genoa, Italy, of humble parents, Christopher Columbus grew up to become an experienced seafarer. He sailed the Atlantic as far as Iceland and West Africa. His adventures convinced him that the world must be round. Therefore, the fabled riches of the East, spices, silk, and gold, could be had by sailing west, superseding the overland route through the Middle East, which the Turks had closed off to commerce. To get funding for his enterprise, Columbus beseeched monarch after monarch in Western Europe. After at first being dismissed by Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, Columbus finally got his chance when Queen Isabella decided to underwrite a modest expedition. Columbus outfitted three pitifully small ships, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, and set forth from Spain. The journey was difficult. The ships sailed west into the unknown Atlantic for more than 2 months. The crew almost mutinied and threatened to throw Columbus overboard. Finally, they reached the West Indies on October the 12th, 1492. And although Columbus made three more voyages to America, he never really knew that he had discovered a new world. He died in obscurity, unappreciated and penniless. Yet, without his daring, American history would have been very different, for in a sense, Columbus made it all possible. Now there's a typical introduction for Columbus in a modern history textbook. Unfortunately, almost everything in this traditional account is either wrong or it's unverifiable. You see, the authors of history textbooks have taken us on a trip of their own away from the facts of history into the realm of myth. They and we have been duped by an outrageous concoction of lies, half-truths, truths, and omissions that is in large part traceable to the first half of the 19th century. The textbook's first mistake is to underplay previous explorers, people from other continents who had reached the Americas many times before 1492, including the Indians who met Columbus on the beach when he arrived. Even if Columbus had never sailed, other Europeans would have soon reached the Americas. Indeed, Europeans may already have been fishing off of Newfoundland in the 1480s. In a sense, Columbus's voyage was not the first, but the last discovery of the Americas. It was epoch-making because of the way in which Europe responded. Columbus's importance is therefore primarily attributable to changing conditions in Europe, not to his having reached a new continent. After all, North and South America were not new. They'd been there all the time. American history textbooks seem to understand the need to cover social changes in Europe in the years leading up to 1492. So they point out that history passed the Vikings by, and then they devote several pages to the reasons that Europe was ready this time to take advantage of the discovery of America, as one textbook puts it. But unfortunately, none of the textbooks provides substantive analysis of the major changes that prompted this new response from the European continent. All but one of the 12 books that I examined began the Columbus story with Marco Polo and the Crusades. American adventures start simply with Columbus. Here is their composite account of what was happening in Europe. It says, life in Europe was slow-paced. Curiosity about the rest of the world was at a low point. Then, many changes took place in Europe during the 500 years before Columbus's discovery of the Americas in 1492. People's horizons gradually widened and they became more curious about the world beyond their own localities. Europe was stirring with new ideas and many Europeans were filled with burning curiosity. They were living in a period called the Renaissance. What started Europeans thinking new thoughts and dreaming new dreams? Well, a series of wars called the Crusades were partly responsible. The Crusades caused great changes in the ways that Europeans thought and acted. The desire for more trade quickly spread. The old trade routes to Asia had always been very difficult. Unquote. Well, these accounts resemble each other closely. Sometimes different textbooks even use the same phrases. Overall, however, the level of scholarship is discouragingly low, and perhaps because their authors are more at home in American history than European history. They provide no real causal explanations for the age of European conquest. Instead, they argue for Europe's greatness in transparently psychological terms, like people grew more curious. Such arguments make sociologists smile. We know that nobody measured the curiosity level in Spain in 1492, or can with authority compare it to the curiosity level in, say, Norway or Iceland in 1005. Now, can they? Now, here's the account in the American way. What made these Europeans so daring was their belief in themselves. The people of Europe believed that human beings were the highest form of life on Earth. This was the philosophy or belief of humanism. It was combined with a growing interest in technology or tools and their uses. The Europeans believed that by using their intelligence, they could develop new ways to do things. Unquote. Now, this is not the place to debate the precepts or significance of humanism, a philosophical movement that clashed with Orthodox Catholicism. In any case, humanism can hardly explain Columbus, since he and his royal sponsors were devout Orthodox Catholics. They were not humanists. The American Way tells us, nonetheless, that Columbus had the humanists' belief that people could do anything if they knew enough and tried hard enough. This is Columbus as the little engine that could. Several textbooks claim that Europe was becoming richer and that the new wealth led to more trade. Actually, as the historian Angus Calder has pointed out, Europe was smaller and poorer in the 15th century than it had been in the 13th century, owing in part to the bubonic plague. Now, some teachers still teach that their predecessors taught me 40 years ago that Europe needed spices to disguise the taste of bad meat, but the bad Turks cut off the spice trade. Three books, The American Tradition, Land of Promise, and The American Way, repeat this lie. this falsehood. And in the words of Land of Promise, then after 1453, when Constantinople fell to the Turks, trade with the East all but stopped. But A.H. Leibner, that's L-Y-B-Y-E-R, Leibner, disproved this statement in 1915. Turkey had nothing to do with the development of new routes to the Indies. On the contrary, the Turks had every reason to keep the old Eastern Mediterranean route open since they made a profit, they made money from it. So in 1957, Jacques Barzin and Henry Graff published a book that has become a standard treatise for graduate students of history. It's called The Modern Researcher, in which they pointed out how, since 1915, textbooks have perpetuated this particular error. Probably several of the half dozen authors of the offending textbooks encountered The Modern Researcher in graduate school. Somehow, the information did not stick, though, and this may be because blaming the Turks fits with the West's archetypical conviction that followers of Islam are likely to behave irrationally or that they're nasty people. In proposing that Congress declare Columbus Day a national holiday in 1963, Representative Roland Libonati put it this way. He said, quote, his Christian faith gave to him a religious incentive to thwart the piratical activities of the Turkish marauders preying upon the trading ships of the Christian world, unquote. Well, the American tradition, Land of Promise, and the American Way continue to reinforce this archetype of vaguely threatening Islam. College students today are therefore astonished to learn that the Turks and the Moors allowed Jews and Christians freedom of worship at a time when European Christians tortured or expelled Jews and Muslims and actually killed fellow Christians. Not a single textbook tells that the Portuguese fleet in 1507 blocked the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf to stop trade along the old route. And that's because Portugal controlled the new route around Africa. Most textbooks note the increase in international trade and commerce. And some relate the rise of nation-states under monarchies. Otherwise, they do a poor job of describing the changes in Europe that led to the age of exploration. Some textbooks even invoke the Protestant Reformation, although it didn't begin until 25 years after 1492. What's going on here? We must pay attention to what the textbooks are telling us and what they are not telling us. You see, the changes in Europe not only prompted Columbus's voyages and the probable contemporaneous trips to America by the Portuguese, the Basque, the Bristol fishermen, but they also paved the way for Europe's domination of the world for the next 500 years. Except for the invention of agriculture, this was probably the most important, the most consequential development in human history. Our history books ought to discuss seriously what happened and why, instead of supplying vague, nearly circular pronouncements such as this from the American tradition. It says, quote, interest in practical matters in the outside world. Europe led to advances in shipbuilding and navigation. Unquote. Well, perhaps foremost among the significant factors that the textbooks leave out are the advances in military technology. You see, around 1400, European rulers began to commission ever bigger guns and learned to mount them on ships. Europe's incessant wars gave rise to this arms race, which also ushered in refinements in archery, drill, and siege warfare. China, the Ottoman Empire, and other nations in Asia and Africa now fell prey to European arms, and in 1493, the Americas began to succumb as well. It was the power of the white man from Europe that conquered the Americas. If a handful of Europeans came upon the American shores with bows and arrows, they would have been overwhelmed by the superior numbers of the Indians, the natives, who also had bows and arrows. But when the white man came with thunder sticks and explosives and cannons, the natives with their bows and arrows could not withstand that kind of military technology any more than the world today can withstand the American military technology that we just used against the Iraqis or the Afghanis. You know, military technology is what makes the history writers of the world. We're the people with the military technology, and we're the people that write the history. We're the people that tell you, here's what happened. Whether it's true or false doesn't come into the equation, but we're the ones that write the histories. We're the ones with the military power, and we're the ones that do the writing and the telling. Now hang on, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we are among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies, multinational corporations, the lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. the courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, liberties, and property, not the Congress, and certainly not the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to one who is indifferent thereto? And that's because it's a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. It cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor, and it's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. So says United States versus Johnson. That's why I contend that we should listen more to the judges and a lot less to the politicians and lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or your solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click on email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Columbus, lies my teacher told me. You know, we live with the arms race to this day. Since the demise of the Soviet Union, the nuclear arms race may have come to a temporary resting point. But the West's advantage in military technology over the rest of the world, jealously maintained from the 1400s on, remains very much contested. Western nations continue to try to keep non-Western nations disadvantaged in the military technology arena. And just as the 13 British colonies tried to outlaw the sale of guns to Native Americans, the United States now tries to outlaw the sale of nuclear technology to third world countries. Since money is to be made in the arms trade, however, and since all nations need military allies, the arms trade with non-Western nations persists. The Western advantage in military technology is still a burning issue. Nonetheless, not a single textbook mentions arms as a cause of European world domination. In the years before Columbus's voyages, Europe also expanded the use of new forms of social technology: bureaucracy, double-entry bookkeeping, and mechanical printing. Bureaucracy, which today has a negative connotation, was actually a practical innovation that allowed rulers and merchants to manage far-flung enterprises and to do it efficiently. So did double-entry bookkeeping, based on the decimal system which the Europeans first learned from the Arab traders. And the printing press and increased literacy allowed news of Columbus's findings to travel across Europe much faster and much farther than news of the Vikings' expeditions. A third important development was ideological or even theological. Amassing wealth and dominating other people came to be positively valued as the key means of winning esteem on earth and salvation in the hereafter. As Columbus put it, gold is most excellent. Gold constitutes treasure, and he who has it does all that he wants in the world and can even lift souls up to paradise. In 1005, the Vikings intended only to settle Vineland, or Vinland, their name for New England, or more likely the maritime provinces of Canada. By 1493, Columbus planned to plunder Haiti. The sources are perfectly clear about Columbus's motivation. In 1495, for instance, Michael de Cuneo wrote about accompanying Columbus on his 1494 expedition into the interior of Haiti. After he had rested for several days in our settlement, it seemed to the Lord Admiral that it was time to put into execution his desire to search for gold, which was the main reason that he had started on so great a voyage full of so many dangers. Columbus was no greedier than the Spanish, or later the English and the French, but textbooks downplay the pursuit of wealth as a motive for coming to the Americas when they describe Columbus and later explorers and colonists. Even the pilgrims left Europe partly to make money, but you would never know it from our textbooks. The authors apparently believe that to have America explored and colonized for economic gain is somehow undignified, or it's wicked, or evil. A fourth factor affecting Europe's readiness to embrace a new continent was the particular nature of European Christianity. Europeans believed in a transportable, proselytizing religion that rationalized conquest. Followers of Islam share this characteristic. Typically, after discovering an island and encountering a tribe of Indians which was new to them, the Spaniards would read aloud in Spanish what came to be called the requirement. And here is one version: I implore you to recognize the church as a lady, and in the name of the Pope, take the king as lord of this land and obey his mandates. If you do not do it, I tell you that with the help of God, I will enter powerfully against you all. I will make war everywhere in every way that I can. I will subject you to the yoke and obedience to the church and to his majesty. I will make your women and take your women and children and make them slaves. The deaths and injuries that you will receive from here on will be your own fault and not that of his majesty nor of the gentlemen that accompany me. Unquote. Now, having thus satisfied their consciences by offering the Indians a chance to convert to Christianity, the Spaniards then felt free to do whatever they wanted with the people that they had just discovered, including killing them. Now, a fifth development that caused Europe's reaction to Columbus's reports about Haiti to differ radically from reactions to earlier expeditions was Europe's recent success in taking over and exploiting various island societies. On Malta, Sardinia, the Canary Islands, and then later in Ireland, Europeans learned that conquest of this sort was a route to wealth. In addition, new and more deadly forms of smallpox and bubonic plague had arisen in Europe since the Vikings had sailed. Passed on to those the Europeans met, these diseases helped Europe conquer the Americas and later the islands of the Pacific. And except for one paragraph on disease in the American pageant, not one of the 12 textbooks mentions either of these factors as contributing to European world dominance. Now, why is it that the textbooks mention arms as a facilitator of exploration and domination? Or why don't the textbooks mention arms as a facilitator of exploration and domination? And why don't they treat any of the foregoing factors? If crude factors such as military power or religiously sanctioned greed are perceived as reflecting badly on us, who exactly is this us? And who are the textbooks written for? And by plainly descendants of the Europeans, aren't they? High school students don't usually think about the rise of Europe to world domination. It's rarely presented as a question. It seems natural. It's a given, not something that needs to be explained. Deep down, our culture encourages us to imagine that we are richer and more powerful because we're smarter. Of course, there are no studies showing Americans to be more intelligent than, let's say, Iraqis. Still, since textbooks don't identify or encourage us to think about the real causes as to why we're smarter, it festers as a possibility. Also, left festering is the notion that it's natural for one group to dominate another. While history brims with examples of national domination, it also is full of counterexamples. The contact between Norse and Indians around 1000 AD, for example, though mostly unfriendly, was not marked by domination. The triracial Native American societies that developed after 1492 from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts through Florida to Ecuador, also offer evidence that domination is not natural, but rather it's cultural. The way American history textbooks treat Columbus and his reinforces the tendency not to think about the process of domination. The traditional picture of Columbus landing on the American shore shows him dominating immediately, and this is a basic fact. Columbus claimed everything that he saw right off the boat. When textbooks celebrate this process, they imply that taking the land and dominating the Indians was inevitable, if not natural. This is unfortunate because Columbus's voyages constitute a splendid teachable moment. As official missions of a nation-state, they exemplify the new Europe. Merchants and rulers collaborated to finance and authorize them. The second expedition was heavily armed. Columbus carefully documented the voyages, including directions, currents, shoals, and descriptions of the Indians as ripe for subjugation. And thanks to the printing press, detailed news of Haiti and later conquests spread swiftly through Europe. Columbus had a personal experience of the Atlantic Islands recently taken over by Portugal and Spain, as well as with the slave trade in West Africa. And most important, his purpose from the beginning was not mere exploration or even trade, but rather it was conquest and exploitation, for which he used religion as a rationale. If textbooks included these facts, they might induce students to think intelligently about why the West dominates the world today. The textbooks concede that Columbus did not start from scratch. Every textbook account of the European exploration of the Americas begins with Prince Henry, the navigator of Portugal, between 1415 and 1460. Henry is portrayed as discovering Madeira and the Azores and sending out ships to circumnavigate Africa for the first time. The textbook authors seem unaware that ancient Phoenicians and Egyptians sailed at least as far as Ireland and England, reached Madeira and the Azores, traded with the aboriginal inhabitants of the Canary Islands, and sailed all the way around Africa, including North and South America, before 600 BC. And instead, the textbooks credit Bartolomeu Dias with being the first around the Cape of Good Hope at the southern tip of Africa in 1488. Totally omitting the accomplishments of the Afro-Phoenicians is ironic, because it was Prince Henry's knowledge of their feats that inspired him to replicate them. But this information clashes with another social archetype. Our culture views modern technology as a European development. So the Afro-Phoenicians' feats do not conform to the textbook's overall storyline about how white Europeans taught the rest of the world how to do things. Nor does it square with nor fit well with evolutionary philosophy. None of the textbooks credits the Muslims with preserving Greek wisdom, enhancing it with ideas from China, India, and Africa, and then passing on the resulting knowledge to Europe by way of Spain. Instead, they show Henry inventing navigation and imply that before Europe there was nothing, at least nothing modern. It was, in fact, Henry's work that was based mostly on ideas that were known to be ancient Egyptian and Phoenician and had been developed further in Arabia, North Africa, and China. Even the word the Portuguese applied to their new ships, caravel, derived from the Egyptian caravos. Cultures do not evolve in a vacuum. Diffusion of ideas is perhaps the most important cause of cultural development. Contact with other cultures often triggers a cultural flowering. Anthropologists call this phenomenon effleurance. Children in elementary school learn that Persian and Mediterranean civilizations flowered in antiquity due to their location on trade routes. Here, with Henry at the dawn of European world domination, textbooks have a golden opportunity to apply this same idea of cultural diffusion to Europe. They squander it, though. Not only did Henry have to develop new instruments according to the American way, but people didn't know how to build seagoing ships, either. Students are left without a clue as to how Aborigines ever reached Australia. Polynesians reached Madagascar, or Afro-Phoenicians reached the Canary Islands. By people, way means, of course, Europeans, a textbook example of Eurocentrism. These books are expressions of what the anthropologist Stephen Jett calls the doctrine of the discovery of America by Columbus. Table 1 provides a chronological list of expeditions that may have reached the Americas before Columbus, with comments on the quality of the evidence for each as of 1994. And while the list is long, it is still probably incomplete. A map found in Turkey dated 1513 and said to be based on material from the Library of Alexander the Great includes coastline details of South America and Antarctica. Ancient Roman coins keep turning up all over the Americas, north and south, causing some archaeologists to conclude that Roman seafarers visited the Americas more than once. Native Americans also crossed the Atlantic. Anthropologists conjecture that Native Americans voyaged east millennia ago from Canada to Scandinavia or Scotland. Two Indians shipwrecked in Holland around 60 BC became major curiosities in Europe. The evidence for each of these journeys offers fascinating glimpses into the societies and cultures that existed on both sides of the Atlantic and in Asia long before 1492. They also reveal controversies among those who study the distant past, and if textbooks allowed for controversy, they could show students which claims rest on strong evidence and which claims are actually on softer ground. There's a number of programs that I've done on America B.C., Barry Feld, and Stephen Collins' books on the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel found, which documents many of these findings of Europeans, in fact, of people from all over the world coming to North and South America long before Columbus. All right, we got to take a little break here, so stand by, and we'll be right back right after this break, so don't go away. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules when we're talking to the police or government agents, and that is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. It's knowing what to say and when to say it and what not to say and who not to say it to that's summed up in this maxim of law. It says all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these. Now listen to this first judge. He said, quote, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? That comes from U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester, wouldn't I? Listen to the second judge. He said, you can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. That comes from Belknap versus United States. Now, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. But listen to this third judge. Here's what he had to say. Quote, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent as well as the innocent and the farsighted. And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. For more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at the law school, 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're taking a look here at Lies My Teacher Told Me, published by New York Press, copyright 1995. The author, James Loewen, L-O-E-W-E-N, Lies My Teacher Told Me. We took a look at Woodrow Wilson, Helen Keller, the whole concept of history being written by the winners. So when we take a look at the Civil War, written from the perspective of Northern historians, we get a different perspective than history written by Southern historians about the same facts. And what we see here isn't so much that they lie directly to us, it's lying by omission. It's what they leave out. It's what they don't tell us. It's where they take the Gettysburg Address and they quote one or two lines out of it, but they leave the rest of it out. Or they take selected statements out of context and then quote them off point to create a desired effect. We see that in politics today. The advertisements that the Republicans are putting out, let's say in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana concerning the Republican position on abortion is different than the advertisements that are put out in California, Washington, and Oregon. Why is that? Well, it's because the Republicans want to appeal to voters in California, and they don't want to tell them that we're really anti-pro-choice. And then when they go down to Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, they want to exemplify the fact that they are pro-choice. And the Democrats do the same thing. When they put their ads on out in California, they put their ads out and they say, well, we want to show you that we're really pro-choice, but they don't want to say that in Alabama where it's not popular. So they tone that down. So what it is, it's lying to us in the Madison Avenue way of doing things. It's we will hold back the truth. We won't tell you what we're really doing, what we really believe, but we'll tell you some of it. We'll tell you what you want to hear. Now, in looking at European discoveries here in the West, the evidence for each of these journeys offers fascinating glimpses into the societies and cultures that existed on both sides of the Atlantic and in Asia long before 1492, and they also reveal controversies among those who study the distant past. If textbooks today allowed for controversy, they could show students which claims rest on strong evidence and which rest on softer ground. And as they challenge students to make their own decisions as to what probably happened, they would also be introducing students to the various methods and forms of evidence: oral history, written records, cultural similarities, linguistic changes, human blood types, pottery, archaeological dating, plant migrations, that researchers use to derive knowledge about the distant past. But unfortunately, textbooks seem locked into rhetoric of certainty. James West Davidson and Mark H. Little, co-authors of the textbook The United States, A History of the Republic, have also written After the Fact. It's a book for college history majors in which they emphasize that history is not a set of facts, but a series of arguments, issues, and controversies. Davidson's and Little's high school textbook, however, like its competitors, presents history as answers, not questions. Why is this? Why do we tell one story to high school students and a different story to college students by the same authors? New evidence that emerges as archaeologists and historians compare American cultures with cultures in Africa, Europe, and Asia may confirm or disprove these arrivals. Keeping up with such evidence is a lot of work. To tell about earlier explorers, textbook authors would have to familiarize themselves with sources such as those cited in the three preceding footnotes. And it's easier just to retell the same old familiar Columbus story. Seven of the 12 textbooks that I studied at least mentioned the expeditions of the Norse. These daring sailors reached America in a series of voyages across the North Atlantic, establishing communities on the Faroe Islands, Iceland, and Greenland. The Norse colony on Greenland lasted 500 years from 982 to 1500 AD. As long as the European settlement of the Americas has lasted up until now, from 1500 to 2000. From Greenland, a series of expeditions, some planned, some accidental, reached various parts of North America, including Baffin Island, Labrador, Newfoundland, and New England. Textbooks that mention the Viking expeditions minimize them. Land of Promise writes, quote, they merely touched the shore briefly and then sailed away. Perhaps the authors of Promise did not know that around 1005, Thorfinn and Gudrid Karlsefni led a party of 65 or 165 or 265 homesteaders. The old Norse sagas vary, and they came with livestock and supplies to settle Vinland or Vinland. They lasted 2 years. Gudrid gave birth to a son. Then conflict with Native Americans caused them to give up. This trip was no isolated incident. The Norse were still exploring wood, or exporting rather, wood from Labrador to Greenland 350 years later. Some archaeologists and historians believe that the Norse got as far down the coast as North Carolina. The Norse discoveries remained known in Western Europe for centuries and were never forgotten in Scandinavia. Columbus surely learned of Greenland and probably also of North America if he visited Iceland in 1477, as he claimed to have done. And it may be fair to say that the Vikings' voyages had little lasting effect on the fate of the world. Should textbooks therefore leave them out, is the question. Is impact on the present the sole reason for excluding an event or fact of history? It cannot be, of course, or our history books would shrink to 20-page pamphlets. We include the Norse voyages not for their ostensible geopolitical significance, but because including them gives a more complete picture of the past. Moreover, if textbooks would only intelligently compare the Norse voyages to Columbus's second voyage, they would help students understand the changes that took place in Europe between 1000 and 1500 AD. And as we shall see, Columbus's second voyage was 10 times larger than the Norse attempts at settlement. The new European ability to mobilize was in part responsible for Columbus's voyages taking on their awesome significance. And although seafarers from Africa and Asia may also have made it to the Americas, they never made it into the history textbooks. The best known are the voyages of the Phoenicians, probably launched from Morocco, but ultimately from Egypt, that are said to have reached the Atlantic coast of Mexico about 750 B.C. Organic material associated with colossal heads of basalt that stand along the eastern coast of Mexico has been dated to around 750 BC. The stone heads are realistic portraits of West Africans, according to the anthropologist Ivan van Sermita, who has done much to bring these images into popular consciousness. Now, around the same time, Indians elsewhere in Mexico created small ceramic and stone sculptures of what seemed to be Caucasoid and Negroid faces. As Alexander von Uthenau, who collected many such terracotta statues, put it, quote, "It is contradictory to elementary logic and to all artistic experience that an Indian would depict in a masterly way the head of a Negro or a white person without missing a single racial characteristic unless he had seen one." Now, although some scholars have dismissed the Caucasoid images as stylized, Indian heads and the Negroid faces as representing jaguars or human babies, the faces nonetheless stare back at us, steadfastly Caucasoid or Negroid, hard to explain away. Ivan van Sertima and others have adduced additional bits of evidence, including similarities in looms and other cultural elements, identical strains of cotton that probably required human intervention to cross the Atlantic, and information in Arab historical sources about extensive ocean navigation by Africans and Phoenicians in the 8th century B.C. Now, what's the importance today of these African and Phoenician predecessors to Columbus? Well, like the Vikings, they provide a fascinating story, one that can hold high school students on the edge of their seats. We might also realize another kind of importance by contemplating the particular meaning of Columbus Day. Italian Americans infer something positive about their national character from the exploits of their ethnic ancestors. The American sociologist George Homans once quipped, explaining why he had written on his own ancestors in East Anglia rather than on some large group elsewhere. He said, "They may be humans, but not Homans." Similarly, Scandinavians and Scandinavian Americans have always believed the Norse sagas about the Vikings, even when most historians did not believe them, and finally confirmed them by conducting archaeological research in Newfoundland, and have now conclusively proved that these Norse sagas were in fact historically accurate. If Columbus is especially relevant to Western Europeans and the Vikings to Scandinavians, what then is the meaning to African Americans of the pre-Columbian voyagers from Africa? After visiting the von Uthenau Museum in Mexico City, and the Afro-Carib scholar Niho Narva wrote, quote, "With his unique collection surrounding me, I had an eerie feeling that veils obscuring the past had been torn asunder. Somehow, upon leaving the museum, I suddenly felt that I could walk taller for the rest of my days." Von Sertima's book is in its 16th printing, and he is lionized by black undergraduates across America. Rap music groups chant, "But we already had been there," in verses about Columbus. Obviously, African Americans want to see positive images of themselves in American history. So do we all. After all, it's just a matter of telling the truth, isn't it? And as with the Norse, including the Afro-Phoenicians, gives a more complete and complex picture of the past, showing that navigation and exploration did not begin with Europe in the 1400s. And like the Norse, the Afro-Phoenicians illustrate human possibility. In this case, black possibility, or more accurately, the prowess of multiracial societies. And unlike the Norse, the Africans and Phoenicians seem to have made a permanent impact on the Americas. You see, the huge stone statues in Mexico imply as much. It took enormous effort to quarry these basalt blocks, each weighing 10 to 40 tons, move them from quarry 75 miles away, and then sculpt them into heads 6 to 10 feet tall. Now, wherever these people came from, the human models for these heads were important people, people to be worshipped or obeyed or at least remembered. However, archaeologists have not yet agreed that they were Afro-Phoenicians, so including the story opens a window through which students can view an ongoing controversy. Of the 12 textbooks that I surveyed, only two even mention the possibility of African or Phoenician exploration. The American Adventure simply poses two questions. What similarities are there between the great monuments of the Maya and those of the ancient Egyptians? And might wind-blown sailors from Asia, Europe, Africa, or the South Pacific have mingled with the earlier inhabitants of the New World? The textbook supplies no relevant information and even claims, quote, you should be able to deal with these questions without doing research, unquote. That's nonsense. It's not even intelligent. Most classrooms will simply ignore the questions. The United States, A History of the Republic, mentions pre-Columbian expeditions only to assure us that we need not concern ourselves with them. None of these Europeans, Africans, or Asians left lasting traces of their presence in the Americas, nor did they develop any lasting relationships with the first Americans. Unsatisfactory as these fragments are, they are the entire treatment of the issue in all 12 textbooks. Now, let me pause there for a second and point something out. You know, they tell us about this land bridge, that the Indians got over here to North and South America thousands of years ago by crossing the land bridge because man was so backward, Neanderthal type, that he couldn't build a boat and sail. And that's the story that we've been hearing all of our lives, and nobody in academia wants to change that. The facts are that for thousands of years, men in Africa, Asia, as well as Europe and Scandinavia, have been sailing regularly over to North and South America, and the artifacts are all over North and South America, and they're simply buried, hidden, and ignored. Well, I'm about out of time. I'll have to take this up again next time when we come back, talking about Columbus and Lies My Teacher Told Me by James Lowen, New York Press, copyrighted 1995. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal, says my time is up, so I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.